Jamie Tijerina, thank you so very much for joining me for the 73rd episode of JT the LA Storyteller Podcast. You are an extraordinary citizen in the city of Los Angeles for very many reasons, including that you are a Caltech scientific researcher, the first one we've had on this podcast, which makes me really happy to note. You're also a part of the LA Budget Advocates for Region 8, or the Northeast Side of Los Angeles. You are a former Highland Park Neighborhood Council representative, and you're also a former candidate for Council District 14, which includes Highland Park and Lincoln Heights, as well as Boyle Heights and a number of neighborhoods in the downtown area, as well as the Northeast Side. So Jamie, thank you so very much for joining us. Would you say a little bit about yourself or introduce yourself to our listenership, por favor?
Sure. So thank you for having me and for inviting me to chat about all of the things having to do with LA and the East Side, Northeast communities. So again, JT has gone ahead and introduced many of the things I work on and have worked on in the past. So again, I'm a scientific researcher at Caltech in the Flow Cytometry and Cell Sorting Resource Laboratory. I am one of the budget advocates for Region 8, representing the Northeast and East Side of Los Angeles. I'm the president of the Highland Park Heritage Trust and a past board member of the historic Highland Park Neighborhood Council. And I was raised in Northeast and the East Side of LA, so Lincoln Heights, Highland Park, and Garvanzo, where I currently live now. And I've just been doing a lot of work in the community, trying to correct, or you know, do my bit to correct or at least bring attention to the long-term disinvestment that we've been experiencing for a very long time here, and that despite, you know, the veneer of the renovations of gentrification, that's not any sort of representation of improvement when it comes to some of the systemic issues that have been plaguing us for a very long time.
Oh, absolutely, Jamie. And to know that you're born and raised, especially from the Northeast Side, is so extraordinary for me and for a number of our listeners, I know, because we have a special place on this podcast, that's for sure, for born and raised LA folks doing critical work to uplift the city, to uplift the next generation, but also past and current generations. And actually, among other roles you fill, you're actually the author of a very special report that I happened to come across not long ago titled The Legacy of Redlining in Los Angeles, Disinvestment, Injustice, and Inefficiency, Finding a Path Forward in 2019 and Beyond. I absolutely recommend for listeners to go out and Google this article. I'll also post it in the show notes for you all to facilitate it that much more, but it's really very well done. And so, Jamie, maybe you can tell us a little bit about how this report came about, because it discusses so much of what we've noted just in these first few minutes about disinvestment in our communities and how we move forward, actually.
Yeah, so it came about a few years ago. So the LA Budget Advocates every year puts out a white paper, and we talk about all the different departments. People, the budget advocates go to have meetings with different department heads and have a real conversation about what are the needs of the community versus what is the budget that the departments have, and where can we make up any shortfalls, and what can we do, what kind of advocacy can we do to make things better and get the services that we need in the community. So the white paper provides recommendations from all the departments that meet with us, and they'll be very specific. And so I was invited that year to do the introduction to this white paper, and I was asked and given the opportunity to talk about redlining, and I said yes, please. And so I wrote it, and when I submit it, they're like, well, it's a little bit academic, it's a little long, it might not be right for the paper. And you know, I was a little mad. I was like, well, you know, you asked me to write it and I wrote it. If you don't want this, I was not the one. So I was like, okay. So the thing was, though, it wasn't that they didn't like the work or didn't approve of it. It was that it was long. And they're like, maybe, you know, let's find a way to make this work. And so at that point, one of my colleagues, KJ, brought to my attention the opportunity zones. and was like, we need to talk about this. And so then I went and started to do some more research on it, because at that time I hadn't really heard about it. And so at that point I started to like make the connections, like, oh wow, like a lot of these zones kind of look like they're on top of the zones that were once redlined. Huh, yes. That's interesting. And some of this, and even I have a slide that I've done in the presentation when I've gone to present this paper, where I literally overlay it and you can see it and just visually look at the correlations. I mean, it's not like that in every single part of the map, but in a lot of it, it is. So I included that as well. And I, you know, the point as well was to make connections with the LA city budget and this topic. And it wasn't really a big jump to do. And sadly, in a lot of ways, it kind of ended up being prescient, like, because a year later, we ended up in the pandemic. And we ended up having a lot of unrest, because all of the things that I had begun to bring up in this paper started to come to a boiling point. They exploded. You know, the calls to defund the police, a prime and exact example from the paper is talking about, you know, the $14.6 million in excess benefit plans that basically are paid to 110 at that time, as of December of 2018, 110 retired cops and firefighters collecting pensions that were so high, they exceeded $220,000 per year. That's the pension fund limit set by the IRS. So $14.6 million is what's needed to pay them everything above that $220,000. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, when I first was like trying to find out, okay, what is the limit? Because it didn't say it outright. I had to like go in and try and find it. And I'm out here, you know, guessing. I'm like, well, they must be kind of low. Like, you know, maybe it's like $75,000 or something. Right. And then when I saw it was $220,000, I was like, so you mean to tell me they're getting $220,000 a year already?
Yeah.
And this is in excess of that. And I'm not here to say like people don't deserve stuff, but also like, you know, when we're out here saying that like park rangers are getting $52,000 a year and they're like, there's a shortage of park rangers to do the work now. That doesn't quite make sense. And these are people who are expected to have a college degree, you know, in an environmental or scientific topic, and also go through the police training to just as a formality, because that's who controls that particular department, but they're doing like a lot of environmental work. So it's, you know, and that's just one example, right? This is, you know, inefficiency is injustice. It's a tragedy of the commons where, you know, people, a shared resource is being taken in such a way that it is disproportionately benefiting one person or one set of people at the detriment of others.
You know, it's also such a well done paper. It's written from the perspective of someone who is looking to really highlight for anyone, city planners and community members, all the same, how it is that we have resources as we speak that simply need to be funneled to the appropriate directions. And what I also really appreciate about the paper is your note about student debt and how student debt actually impacts the prospects that graduates, such as ourselves, if you will, have once we enter the job market as people who look to come back to the city or the places they came up in to contribute and be productive members, not just of society, but of the places that we love and of the places that we know so well, right? And so I really liked the mention of student debt and how student debt especially impacts communities of color who've already faced so many barriers to higher education in the first place, right? So,
yes.
So it's a really very well done paper, and I absolutely recommend listeners of the show to go and check it out. And it's interesting because that paper was something that was published during the same year that you'd, of all things, announce a candidacy to represent your council district, the 14th council district, which in 2019 and through 2020 was going through so much. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about how you decided to actually enter your name into the race for council district 14 through 2019, when that district needed to find a new council member after Jose Huizar's disgraceful exit.
Yeah, so, you know, if you would have told me, like, when I was younger, like 10 years ago when I was a kid, like, that I would be running for office, I would have been like, no. That's not a thing. Like, that's crazy. But the thing is, after my time in the neighborhood council, so I was on the historic Highland Park Neighborhood Council from 2016 to 2019, and I learned a lot in this role. One of the colleagues who came after me was like reviewing documentation, and she's like, you are prolific because of the amount of community impact statements I wrote, motions I put in, events that I hosted, things like that. And also the work as well on the budget advocates. I did that in the final year is when I became a budget rep, and then after a budget advocate. And, you know, I was part of the coalition that achieved the sanctuary resolution for LA City when a lot of people thought we were sanctuary city and we weren't. And there's just a lot of things I learned along the way. And I sort of realized that when you're a neighborhood council member, you are given limited resources and not limited, you know, responsibility. You're essentially dropped in, you're elected by the community, either through the elections that are run by the neighborhood councils and by the Department of Neighborhood Empowerment, or through a special election, which is how I got in, that is at that time determined by the board's bylaws, how they fill vacant seats in the middle of a term. And you're kind of dumped in with very minimal training, if any at all. And you really have to rely on the people who are already on the board with you. You rely on your DUN representative, and you do your best, but, you know, your advisory and capacity. There is a limitation to what that is. And a lot of the community, unfortunately, doesn't realize that we have those limitations, and that we have some of those sort of, I guess, handicaps, that we're not given the support that we need, and we have minimal funding. And it's really difficult. And I sort of realized that, you know, I needed to do the next thing, because if you don't have somebody who is in the council office, who cares about the community, who really understands the community and is willing to listen to what the needs are, and actually take action, you're never gonna see progress. And not only that, but I really saw that time, and a lot of the things that have happened as a result of the pandemic sort of confirmed it for me, that we were in a turning point where the decisions that we were gonna make at that time were gonna have a really major impact on how the following years played out. You know, we were really, well, there's never been anyone under the age of 40 on the city council, or at least at that time, there wasn't anyone under 40, more accurately. There's never been a woman to represent CD14 ever. And we were ignoring a lot of issues that, and I think we still are to an extent, at least on a local level, issues that pertain to people under 35, under 40. I feel like once you get past K-12, they don't care about you no more. Right. And you come back, you know, they're like, go to school, get a degree, do this. Cal State LA is in CD14, and, you know, they're recognized by the National Science Foundation for graduating the largest number of Latino students who go on to get PhDs in STEM fields. And when they come home, there's no jobs for them. So you end up with this dystopian cycle of student debt. We have some of the highest levels of student loan debt in the city. And they don't tell you, like, oh, hey, you're going to get your PhD, but did you know that postdoc salaries qualify you for HUD in most major cities, by the way? And you're just going to have all this debt, and the rent's going to be high, and good luck with that. And good luck with the fact that you're probably not going to actually be able to move back to your own neighborhood, because there's no jobs here that pay enough to actually live in it. So you're going to have to go to Thousand Oaks or like San Diego or like somewhere where there's jobs for you. We're like, we'll train you here, but like, good luck with the rest of that. One of the people who responded to one of my messages that I sent to the community when I was running, they were saying that how they were struggling because they couldn't find the mentorship programs and the mentorship opportunities that they needed so that they could even begin a graduate school application to go to like essentially the hard science field. So you usually have to shadow a doctor or shadow a vet or shadow a physical therapist in order to get some of that hands-on experience before you apply to those graduate training schools. And they couldn't get that, and they couldn't get the support to get that in the community. And that's just like one example of like how we end up in this dystopian cycle, and who is talking about that? Because certainly not any of the people in the community spaces that I was in. And it's not that they didn't care, it's just they were focused on other things. And they were, you know, they may not have necessarily had, you know, kids in college. They may have been focused on K through 12 because that's where their kids were at, but not seeing the long-term picture. Not only that, but we had some of the largest amount of industrial zoned land in the city. And that means that's a lot of factory jobs. So at the time there was a lot of conversation about automation and losing jobs to automation. And I was actually, so I was, fun fact, weird flex, but you know, whatever. I was the first candidate in the city of LA ever to campaign on TikTok. And who knew that I was a little early to the game, because now look how big TikTok is.
Oh, that's for sure.
Pandemic. But I was also the first person, the first candidate, LA city candidate, to take a public and unequivocal stance on a pilot study for a universal basic income in Los Angeles. And with the pandemic, given all of that, because we have factory jobs, as I said just a moment ago here, and those are the jobs that stand to be lost to automation. And the place that we didn't see where those would be lost as well, unfortunately, is to a pandemic, where we have a lot of the city's essential workers live here, and our neighborhoods here have been decimated by the pandemic. You know, the East Side, Northeast, East LA, unincorporated LA County have seen really, really terrible casualties to that pandemic. And so, we were vulnerable to begin with. You know, we just didn't know that we were also, that same vulnerability would make us vulnerable to the pandemic in the same way. And so that's why I took that stance for UBI. And now we do have UBIs in other district pilots going on. They're not true UBIs. Yeah.
Right.
They're not true UBIs, but they are a step in the direction. And that's what I was really hoping for, because I'm not, you know, I'm not some savior. Like, no politician is your savior, and nobody should ever look that way to a politician. It's completely unrealistic. You know, politicians are just regular humans who get elected to do a job that's kind of high powered. And when you look at it that way, you have your expectation changes, and you realize like, this is a lot bigger than any of us. So like, how can we, you know, what is it that we do, and how do we work towards what we want to see in our society? So that was a little long-winded, but all of these observations and, you know, trying to really advance conversations, you know, and correct some of this disinvestment, or at least start on a journey towards that, drove me to run for this seat at great risk, because, you know, I was the third person to enter the race, and everyone was like, you're nuts.
Wow.
But, you know, I think it was really important that I did, because I think that my running encouraged other candidates to run. And it also forced some conversations that I don't think that might've been had.
Well, that's absolutely right. Because even now, it's important that you ran. It's important that this candidacy existed. And so, for me, it's interesting to think about this campaign because of the neighborhoods that you mentioned, right? Because mm-hmm. of the essential workers that you've mentioned, because so much of Los Angeles, especially LA over the 1960s and the 1970s, and what people sort of knew about Los Angeles during these critical times, it comes from that Northeast side and that East side in general, right? You've got so much film, so much photography, so much of the Chicano mural arts activism, mm-hmm. all hailing from this historic side of Los Angeles, and really this historic side of the United States, this historic part of the West Coast. And so I'm interested in what your campaigning looked like, and how you were campaigning, and which doors you were knocking on, and what you learned in some of the conversations with community members about the needs these communities had pre-pandemic. I think it's important to meditate on that for a moment for our mm-hmm. listenership.
Well, the thing is, to some degree, like, the pandemic amplified what was already wrong. So we had, again, so that disinvestment, that lack of jobs, the fact that, you know, a lot of folks are in service jobs here, and that's what is here for them as far as employment. That was a big vulnerability point. So you already had people who are struggling financially because sadly those jobs don't pay what they're deserved. You know, they call it, and I don't agree with how they call it, but they call it unskilled work. I'm like, yo, the skills you need to be able to do that work are pretty intense. And there's a lot of people who could never get it right. So, you know, they're not paid, you know, workers are not paid what they need to live. And that's sad. And that was exacerbated. You already had concerns with homelessness and housing insecurity that existed already. And now they became even worse because people were quite literally put out into the streets because they did not have service industry that made these neighborhoods go round wasn't existing. It was quite literally shut down entirely. And people had no money for food. They had no money for the rent, obviously, but no money for food, no money for gas. No, they already didn't have money for healthcare. And so now we have this pandemic that causes insane healthcare costs. There, you know, a solution needed to become up, you know, needed to be put into place for that well before the pandemic and COVID-19 even was in existence. You know, we did have a right-wing undertow. And so because, you know, we were grassroots, my voter targeting sometimes was I would be like, oh, I'm going to this block today. This is on my way home. We're going to hang out here today. And I would just knock on all the doors. And, you know, a lot of people don't answer, but like, I wasn't checking, like, is it a Republican? Is it a Democrat? Is it an independent? Like, I wasn't checking that. And even if I was like, whatever, I'll talk to them because it's a nonpartisan seat, you know, and there's a lot of folks who have right-leaning opinions. And I think that people didn't necessarily realize that. And now we're seeing it. There's a whole recall happening. You know, there's multiple recalls happening. Right. And so it really amplified the existing issues that we already had. There's also population pressure issues. I mean, we have a declining population. And the thing is, anecdotally, I could see it, right? Like, here's an example. When I live near one of the dash lines that 10 years ago was serving a ton of kids from the local middle school and the local high school, because it goes all around Highland Park, Eagle Rock. And so kids would get out of school and they would line up. There was three stops in Garvanza, and there would be so many kids lined up at one that the bus would fill up, and then they would run to the next stop and see if they could maybe get on that bus. And they'd be like running between the stops. Now you don't see no kids. You don't see any of that. Like my little, we had these little bricks outside our house, and they had all the little names, like people would put their names and stuff and tag on it and whatever. There's no new tags. Like I never erased them, but like there's no new ones because there's no kids. So anecdotally, you could see there was fewer kids around. When I was talking to one of the local hair salon owners, she told me, she's like, used to see kids at that bus stop all the time. Now all the kids are gone. And if you look at the recent census results, they just came out because the data embargo came up, and they were just reported on the 19th at one of the redistricting hearings. We've lost about 30,000 people in this region.
Yeah.
So like we could see it happening, but the data just exists now. Right. So like I was seeing all this stuff on the ground, you know, and now I'm just seeing it play out even more loudly. Like, it's not just me looking at it and me having the conversations. It's everybody having those conversations.
Right. This is what we know about our neighborhoods. This is what we have felt about our neighborhoods for so long. And to see the data confirm that is such a sort of difficult moment, but also a crucial moment in that the more we can spread this information along and hand the data over to more and more of our communities, the more we can activate our voices around the issue accordingly, because it has always been that, and it will always be this. And voting is not the only way we activate our voices. You very well know this, and it's going to take a long and very sophisticated effort from the part of those of us in these communities, as well as those who are interested in a truly equitable Los Angeles. It's interesting because even as I think about the Metro Next Gen plan and the implementation of the plan, I can think of a bus line through East Hollywood that also served students 10 years ago on very crucial levels, in that the kids relied on this bus line time and time again. All kids who qualified for the free lunch program, all kids who resided in formerly redlined areas, all kids who today no longer exist in the same way and through the same neighborhoods. And what displacement or banishment of communities of color has led to is just this, right? The elimination of services, the elimination of crucial infrastructural settings that allow communities to survive. You mentioned the millennial aspect just as well, right? We're the largest population since the baby boomers. So what's up, right?
Why are they ignoring us?
Right. We just got through the Great Recession as young professionals in the market. And now we are in the midst of getting through the great pandemic. We can't access housing. We can't access tenure level positions. We can't access an array of resources that we need in order to live and survive and power the society for the next 20, 30, 40 years. And so it's really empowering to know that there's someone out there who's really looking at the generational divide, actually, and noting that, hey, this is important. This is an issue that we need to be discussing day in and day out. I think that's another overdue conversation we need to have in the city.
Totally. And, you know, you mentioned, where are those kids from 10 years ago? Well, if they're the middle school kids, you know, they just finished college. If they were like 12, 13 years old, and they got sent to their doom, quite literally, to graduate into this pandemic, to which, you know, graduating into recession-like conditions will affect your earning potential for the lifespan of your career. And, you know, we sent those kids, those same kids from 10 years ago, to their doom. They have tons of student loan debt, more than even us. You know, they have a weak job market, and they have no, like, not every single one, obviously, because there's going to be a spectrum, but a large percentage aren't going to have a means to be able to pay those student loan debts that they have, and, you know, really live what the quote unquote American dream should have been, you know, getting a house, all these things, because the issues haven't been corrected, and we're still dealing with, you know, resistance to forgive, or at least come up with some kind of meaningful forgive and reform, because you can't just, you know, leave the system as it is. It's messed up.
Right. Even that term, right, Jamie, that term forgive, as though it were some sin to go and educate oneself as to benefit one's community. And so for me, it feels like I'm speaking with a Green New Deal candidate in Los Angeles, and a type of candidate that is also something our communities have been waiting for so long. And it didn't stop there. After the campaign, you realized that there was still far more work to do. And so this actually led to your presidency for the Highland Park Neighborhood Trust. And so would you tell us a little bit about the HP Neighborhood Trust? Tell us what that organization is and what you've all been working on, and why today is a really special day, actually, to discuss your work with this nonprofit or grassroots organization.
Yeah, so I actually joined the board in, I think it was 2018, and I was elected president in 2019. And In this time, so I think it's important for me to mention what happened to my campaign, because that'll kind of lead me in and sort of wrap up what, you know, we kind of talked about with challenges for millennials. So ultimately, the way that I went out wasn't that I lost. It was that I did not make the signature gathering requirements. And it wasn't actually I didn't miss it by a lot. I had a really, really high acceptance rate for my signatures, over 80%, which is actually quite difficult to achieve. But it just kind of shows how meticulous I was about making sure that, you know, while people were doing the signatures, they were doing it right. But I couldn't take enough time off of work to, you know, be able to just dedicate the time. I couldn't pay somebody, because, you know, I was being stubborn. I was like, that's not grassroots. If you can't, you know, get your signatures, that's not grassroots.
I've been there.
And so then, like, but the other thing is that to get signatures, like they could charge you like $5 or more per signature. It's insanity. And so, you know, I gave it my all. And like, you know, we went down, but we went down fighting anyway. And in the end, you know, I say rejection is protection, because, you know, God was watching out for me. Imagine having to try and run a campaign during a pandemic when it's not safe to. Like, I'd literally be endangering myself and others to do it. And, you know, it's in a sense, things happened the way they were supposed to. But, you know, it's very important to note that, you know, young people from our communities, you know, who don't necessarily have access to wealth and the money that you require to get to, you know, to fund a campaign the way that you'd want to, you know, it puts us at a handicap to go down in that manner, you know, in a way that could have been, you know, if with more resources avoided, or it could have been if I would have not had to work, you know. But it ended up kind of being an interesting time right after, because so I, at that point, the lockdown ended up starting just a couple months later. And that changed a lot of what the Heritage Trust was even able to do, because we do things like walking tours as well and other in-person events. We couldn't even fundraise ourselves for the nonprofit, and also a lot of the outreach that one would do to get people to come out to hearings, all these things. So we had been working on the nomination of the Chicano Arts Collectives of Highland Park for quite some time. So the process of doing historic nominations is actually quite onerous and difficult.
Yes, and to be sure, Jamie, just to be sure there, mm-hmm. please explain the Chicano Collectives for a minute so that people know what it was that you nominated in the first place for this historic cultural monument status.
Yes, so during the 70s, largely, so the 60s and 70s were the time of the Chicano movement. So the Northeast and East Side communities are largely regarded as the birthplace of the Chicano movement. And the thing is, less than 10% of historic landmarks are associated with communities of color. It's widely known already that a lot of the places that were important for the Chicano movement, for Latino culture in the United States, are at risk. They're at risk of demolition. They're at risk of becoming dilapidated or just going into disrepair and generally disappearing. You know, all five of the schools that were part of the Chicano walkouts, Chicano blowouts, they are listed as endangered places that are a threat of demolition. One particular example was the very recent loss of the R building and the auditorium at Roosevelt High School in Boyle Heights. You know, this was a very important and significant place in Chicano history for its role in the walkouts, and it was demolished. And, you know, they're rebuilding that, you know, there's a whole other conversation around, you know, putting resources and modernization and things like that. But having a historic resource like that in a school, there's so much lost potential for educating the kids about, you know, the civil rights movement that gave us, you know, a lot of improvements, you know, that gave Latinos a lot of improvements in the United States, to demolish this piece of history and to know that the rest of the spaces and many others, just like the ones that we nominated, are at risk, is something very significant to keep in mind. So we have in Highland Park a lot of issues with loss of culture, loss of murals, loss of art, loss of local Latino businesses. And one of the things that happens is people nominate stuff when it is imminently at risk of being knocked down, like tomorrow kind of thing. And we have the Chicano Arts Collectives of Highland Park. So the Centro de Arte Público, Mexicano Arts Center, and Corazon Productions, that they're not at any sort of imminent threat yet, you know, and we decided this is the perfect time to nominate these so that we can really look at seriously protecting them. The artists who are part of this they've been aging, and we've already lost some, you know, to time. And it's really important to recognize people while they're still here. It's important to recognize places while they still exist. And it's important to try and find a way. And so I'll read to you just a little bit directly from the nomination.
Absolutely.
So I think, and these are all publicly available, and I can send them to you as well so that you can upload them and make them easily accessible to the community who listens to this podcast. But
we'll upload it on jimbotimes.com for readers. Yes.
Perfect. So the Centro de Arte Público meets criterion one for its association with a specific event that marks an important moment in the cultural, social, and artistic history of Los Angeles. So the Centro de Arte Público is a politically informed arts group situated on the second floor of a commercial building in Highland Park neighborhood of Los Angeles. The founders of the Centro de Arte Público sought to uphold and spread communist ideals and strove to foster greater inclusivity in the arts. Members established the group with an intent to usher a social, cultural, and political revolution. The group's publication, Chisme Arte, reflected the Centro's ideals and created a new platform for the local dissemination of Latino news. Members of the Centro de Arte Público was also formative for the rise of Chicana rhetoric and art, and notable Latina artists started their careers at the Centro de Arte Público and found a platform for their work in Chisme Arte. So this is important because at that time, a lot of the mainstream media was very Anglo-centric and focused on Anglo news. And so a lot of the artists and a lot of the writers were shut out of that, and they were limited, and they were limited to only Spanish language media, which is, you know, it's good to be part of that, but when you want more, you know, when you deserve to be given the equal opportunity to share what you are working on, your art, your writing, why is that not in existence? So these artists created their own thing. And so this is just part of it. They also, this particular nomination for El Centro meets criterion two for its association with significant local personages who were instrumental in the growth and appreciation of Chicano and Chicana art in Los Angeles. In particular, the group's founder, Carlos Almaraz, dramatically altered how the mainstream art world displayed and addressed Chicano art, and several other significant artists who also gained experience and recognition while involved with the Centro include significant Chicana artists like Judith Hernandez, Barbara Carrasco, and Dolores Cruz. And so, Wow. Yeah, this is huge. And so I'll go ahead and read you from the Mexicano Art Center as well, just to make sure that you have both complete, that everybody has complete information. And again, it's a very long nomination, so it'll be beneficial for anyone to read it on their own time. But the Mexicano Art Center meets criterion one for its association with important events of local history that made significant contributions to the development of the cultural, social, and artistic history of Los Angeles. As one of the earliest Chicano art centers in Los Angeles, the Mexicano Art Center revolutionized the way that Latino art was produced, displayed, and received. And prior to its creation, mainstream art galleries were largely Anglo-centric, as I mentioned before, and failed to show art made by Latinos. The Mexicano Art Center changed this status quo by providing a venue where Chicanos and Chicanas could practice and exhibit their art. And as a result, Chicano art and artists were better able to gain recognition in the greater art world. So one of the things I also want to mention, so in talking about all of this really major cultural significance, one of the other reasons there's a big disparity between, you know, having nominations of places that were important in Latino history is the fact that oftentimes there's a big focus on the architecture making a place historic. And that's a much more quantitative sort of metric to look at, you know. But what is really important, what needs to be looked at more closely in communities of color, is this cultural aspect, because these are very important cultural contributions that happened in these places. And that's what makes these places particularly important. Like, yes, they do have very unique architectural characteristics, but the culture, you won't find it nowhere else. So that's, you know, we really want to shift that paradigm and make sure and show that you can have a nomination because something is culturally significant, because it's important and you have to recognize it. And this should not be the last one, you know, like this. This should be just the beginning.
I see what you're saying, Jamie. You're saying that this is, these particular sites happen to be located in Highland Park and are especially relevant to the Chicano civil rights movements and the creation of the Chicano movement through the nation, after all. But it's also the case that culture exists throughout the city of Los Angeles. And mm-hmm. this is just one step in the direction of nominating more of our cultural hallmarks to these statuses, that is protected statuses as historic cultural monuments for our communities.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And so we're now that, you know, now that we've successfully had these nominations, which is, it's huge. It's really exciting. And we're also collaborating with Avenue 50 Studio on the nomination for some murals locally, the Quetzalcoatl mural that's on what used to be a furniture store at one point. That's when I remember them painting it when I was a kid. It was a furniture store. And then later it became a hair school, and now it's vacant because it so goes the world, unfortunately. But the mural remains. And so we want that mural to remain forever. Wow. You know, so that's being nominated. And again, that's in conjunction with Avenue 50 Studios. Just one of our board members is making themselves available to support it. Also adding the mural that's at the Southwest Museum to that existing HCM. And then finally, the third and final nomination in the set of collectives of Corazon Productions. We're almost completed. There's just a couple more finishing touches that we would like to put on it in order to make it as strong as it can be, to give it the best chance of being voted an approval, in addition to obviously community support. So
right. And let's be sure that listeners understand that actually today, that is August 24th, 2021, the LA City Council took a vote on the Chicano Collective's buildings in Highland Park. And would you tell us a little bit about the vote and the result today, Jamie?
Absolutely. So today was, again, so the culmination of a very long process. So as I mentioned, I was elected to the board as the president, although I was on the board prior in 2019. We had started this around 2018. So that means that the writing and research process of these nominations had started then. So that puts us at 2018, 2019, 2020, 2021, 3 years, at least 3 years of work, hours and hours. One of our board members agreed to do this pro bono. Her name is Alexandra Madsen. And when I speak about true allyship, this is it. This is exhibit A for true allyship. Somebody who is willing to put in hundreds and hundreds, at least over 1,000 hours to make this happen and do the writing and research needed to be done to support this. And so we submitted the nominations to the Cultural Heritage Commission, and you'll see the dates on the documents when they're uploaded in February of 2020. So exact February 1st, 2020, to be exact, just before the pandemic hit. And so we didn't get a date for the first hearing until October of 2020. And that was the first hearing in front of the Cultural Heritage Commission for them to decide if they would undertake the process to be able to consider these nominations for HCM status and be able to decide if they wanted to recommend them for the next step. So that hearing was October 1st, and it passed. So they said, yes, we're gonna consider these. So then the time period passed, and it took a little bit longer because of the pandemic. There's usually an in-person walkthrough schedule. I actually, day of the day of that, I ended up getting exposed to somebody who contracted COVID at work. And so I had to quarantine, and that was, thankfully they're okay, thank God. And I didn't get COVID, but I had to quarantine. So I ended up on my way home, I drove past and I took some pictures and submitted them to the commission, and the commissioners were going to have to do the walkthrough on their own. And in January of 2021, the commission voted to recommend these for HCM status. So the next step in that process is them going to the vote in front of the Planning and Land Use Management Committee of the LA City Council. So that vote happened actually last week, August 17th, 2021. So there was a long time in between January and August, largely because of the pandemic and scheduling. And then it happened fast. I found out over the weekend that they scheduled the final hearing today, and it passed. We had tons of public comments that were written in the previous hearings. We had tons of people call in to the meetings for public comment, write in. We had letters from numerous nonprofits and numerous elected officials who supported it and recognized that this was important. And today it was voted unanimously as a yes.
Wow. Almost a year since this nomination was even considered by the LA City Council, and ultimately 3 years since the effort to nominate these buildings first began. Today, you finally have affirmation that all this work, all this documentation, all this community building, allyship, and organizing has in fact come to fruition and delivered these results for you all and for the communities that you seek to protect and uplift here, Jamie. So I really want to congratulate you on this major achievement, because as you've noted, this is in Highland Park right now on the Northeast LA side, but this is an example for communities everywhere who've got cultural hallmarks and cultural monuments that simply have not been designated as such and recognized officially as such, but which have certainly been recognized by our communities over the course of so much time, and which now we've got all the more room to create visibility and recognition for.
Yeah. No, and I think just, you know, I went in a little long-winded to tell you about the process, because I think it's, you know, it's important to really show how onerous it is and understand why so many communities haven't been able to do it, because, you know, I think that's the next frontier. How do we make doing all this work equitable and fair? Because expecting all of it to be volunteer forever, I mean, people who are working class, who are struggling, you know, a big reason that a lot of these civil rights violations that our community has experienced, you know, in the decades past especially, happened was because, you know, there was this idea that they wouldn't have the political power or the ability to fight because they're too busy working. You know, it's not right. And so, like, you know, having that conversation about what do we do next to make this less onerous? What do we do next to bring the resources into the community so that we can make this happen, you know, and support people in being able to find the steps for the process to be able to do it? And, you know, I think that's the next steps in terms of the conversation.
I think that's absolutely right, that that's the next step. And throughout our conversation, really, we've spoken about what it is like for communities to invest in themselves ultimately, right? And for us to take the resilience we've seen from those around us and apply it to our own movements, our own community making, our own development of culture and protection of the culture throughout our cities, throughout our communities, throughout Los Angeles. And so I'm really excited that the city of Los Angeles can now hear from the work that you and your communities have done over these past few years, and that more folks out there can inform themselves as to, yes, how onerous this process has been, how important it is that we find ways to facilitate it for the next generation of activists and community organizers and allies, because it's a combination of these things. It will not hail just from one place. Every community's needs are just slightly different, even though when it comes to working class communities, the fact is we are all owed equity, but on our terms and on terms that our communities decide are fair for us and then some, right? So, Jamie, this has been such a such an informative conversation, and I really sort of only want to speak with you further about more efforts throughout this city, throughout our communities. But for now, I want to give you the opportunity to shout out your crew, your team members, all the people that have led you to declare this day a victory for the Chicano collectives in Highland Park, and all the people who supported your candidacy in 2019, and all the folks who will continue working with you to uplift these neighborhoods.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I'm grateful for the opportunities that, you know, have come, you know, my way to be able to do this, and that, you know, I've been able to actually do something about it. You know, I am really grateful to everybody who took the time, right? Like, so, you know, obviously the Highland Park Heritage Trust, you know, I'm grateful to this organization for providing the space to be able to do something like this and to be able to create the community connections to the artists, to different historians to be able to get to this point. You know, I'm grateful to all the people who believed in me along the way and, you know, supported the work itself and were willing to give of themselves and their time, you know, also as volunteers, you know, the friends on the, what I believe to be lifelong friendships of, you know, people who I met on the campaign. And just, you know, there's so many people, like I couldn't even just single it out, you know? But I think it just goes to show, right? Like doing this work, the only way it's about you is in that you need to take care of yourself so that you could continue to do it. And, you know, keep yourself mentally healthy and mentally strong so that you can continue and have the thick skin that you need in order to go through some of the difficult times that you'll go through. But ultimately, the work itself, it's not about you. It's about everybody who, you know, needs the empowerment, who is looking for, you know, a roadmap or ideas to be able to, you know, create the improvements that they want to see. And to everyone who's willing to do that work alongside you and not expect anything in return other than the hope for an improved future. You know, these are the people and things that I'll remember and that I'll always be thankful for. And I hope that everybody has, you know, has community and support around them like this